Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Lindsay Adman, physician and assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan, about the recent rise in opioid and meth use in pregnancy. Pretty shocking study we talked about not too long ago on Research That Matters, and we decided to actually have a full, deeper conversation with the author of that study. Really looking forward to that conversation. But first, we're going to talk about some research that matters on some other issues. And the very first one I want to talk about is an article that was published in the journal BMC Public Health about binge eating and smoking as they relate to bullying and sexual abuse. And in this new research, the investigators looked at over 3,000 Australians who had face-to-face interviews that looked at when they had the onset of bullying and how long they had it, and if they had had sexual assaults, and then looked to see how and when these occurred and how they were related to harmful behaviors later on. So if they had bullying when they were teenagers or sexual abuse when they were young, or did that relate to ultimately taking up habits like smoking, binge eating, taking excess medications. And what they found is that if those who had suffered bullying or sexual abuse, they were 3 times more likely to be binge eaters than those who had never experienced that abuse. They were 4 times more likely to be on antidepressants, and they were twice as likely to be smoking cigarettes. And if they had 2 or more adverse outcomes, so let's say they both smoked cigarettes and they were binge eaters, or they used antidepressants and they smoked, the probability that they actually had had a bullying or sexual abuse experience was 60 to 85%. Pretty shocking. From a physician standpoint, you know, we see these unhealthy habits pretty frequently, but I don't think we oftentimes think or trace these to bullying or sexual abuse. And certainly this is a red flag to say, well, we should be aware of that because we may be missing underlying causes behind some of these unhealthy behaviors. I think from patients, it's to say that, you know, we need to do a better job of listening and hearing and asking. Our next research that matters is really important to millions of people around the globe and in America is those who take sleeping pills or something to help their sleep. And a lot of the traditional medications that people have taken over the years, medicines called benzodiazepines, things that are like Valium or Xanax or Ativan, brand names of some of these medications, Klonopin, looking at how those drugs relate to perhaps newer medications, these medications that are called dual orexin receptor antagonists, that's a mouthful, DORAs, and do they have the same impact on kind of sleep, not just in having you fall asleep, but waking up? Because there's some concern that the older medicines, it's very difficult to wake up from. And so they actually did a really interesting study. They tested it in mice. One thing I found out is that mice are more active when it's dark outside. I guess that explains why you hear them in your trash cans in your kitchen after the lights go out. And one group of these mice were given a DORA, a sleep medicine analog, and another were given a benzodiazepine, the older medicine, and a third group was given a placebo. And they found that the two sleep medicines actually had a similar sleep kind of effect and were much better than the placebo in terms of the sleep effect. But then they kind of woke these mice up 1 to 4 hours after they got the medicine with a threatening stimulus, the smell of a fox. Or they got a high-pitched noise like a dog whistle. Please do not do that in ways that I can hear it in my own bed. Or trembling of their cage. And as expected, those who perhaps were on the benzodiazepine drug, they kind of had delayed response. But that those who were on the DORA type of sleep medicine woke up. And then afterwards, they went back to sleep. Personally, I think if you shake my cage, I'm not going right back to sleep, no matter what you give me. But be that as it may, what they were talking about is that these newer medicines maybe avoid this hangover effect. They allow you to go back to sleep, but they kind of wake you up. A downside, because there's one of these drugs that is available in the United States. The downside is I believe it's over $10, maybe $13 per pill. Now, if you have insurance, maybe it's certainly less expensive and maybe a copay. But for a lot of people out there, this would be really prohibitive. But it's interesting. It's something you may want to talk about with your physician. This was done in mice. I don't hope they don't do this study in humans. Our next research that matters really talks about something that I've often thought about but haven't seen a whole lot of research on, is that people who miss their appointments with doctors, what is their risk of adverse health outcomes? I'm aware a lot of times when patients miss their appointment with me that these are patients who never miss an appointment. So like I know that there's something wrong, they miss their appointment. I call them other patients that may not know as well and they miss an appointment and I, you know, we're busy and we may not think as much about it. Particularly maybe sometimes patients who maybe have depression or anxiety may think, oh, it wasn't a good day for them. However, we should rethink this because this was the largest study of its kind in Scotland where 500,000 patients who had appointment histories were tracked for 3 years between 2013 and 2016. And they found that those who had more long-term health conditions were increased risk of missing appointments and had greater risk of death. And if they missed two or more appointments in the previous year, they had a threefold increase in death over those who didn't miss appointments and an eight times greater risk of death that they actually had mental health conditions and they missed two or more appointments. This is like ding, 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 a red flag here for, I think, providers to really do more work. You know, we do all this quality improvement work we talked about recently with one of our great guests from the American College of Physicians about how we do quality improvement to address these gaps in care. Well, one of the gaps is we're not doing enough to understand and try to prevent kind of these missed appointments and understand what people need. It might be transportation or other things they may need to do to help get to appointments there and take this seriously. Our last research that matters is what my grandmother might have called a Yiddish word, Chandra, a disgrace. It's the social inequities of care, and this is how it relates in healthcare. And this was a major study in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. We'll probably talk with our guest today about this. And it was about how poor people in the United States, poor women in specifically, can't afford tampons and pads, can't afford the menstrual hygiene products. And it wasn't just they can't afford them occasionally during the year. Many can't afford them every month, and they're making do with toilet paper or cloth or rags or diapers or paper towels. And half the women who were surveyed in a low income in St. Louis, a low income large city, said half the women said there were times when they could not afford to buy both food and these menstrual products. So clearly they went for food. And it turns out these products aren't covered by most of the things that low-income women might get help with, such as programs like WIC, Women and Children's Assistance. They have a difficult time getting transportation to get these, buying them in bulk. And products are distributed to shelters and other places for these women to get these. But it's just really, I think, a disgrace. And this is even as early as last year, as late as last year, 64% of the women unavoid these products, couldn't afford them in the previous year, and 21% were on a monthly basis. We must and we can do better. This will conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Lindsay Adman, physician and assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan, about the recent rise in opioid and meth use in pregnancy. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Lindsay Adman, physician and assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan, about the recent rise in opioid and meth use in pregnancy. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Adman.
Thanks, Adam. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, you know, as I told you in our preparation that we were talking about your research not too long ago on the show and the article you read in, I said, you know, we need to have you on the show. This is too important. And I was just so struck by this. But before we get into this difficult problem, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you become involved and interested in medicine and obstetrics as a career?
Sure. So what actually drew me into medicine was that my mom had breast cancer when I was pretty young. And I've really always been drawn to women's health for that reason. In my undergraduate studies, I majored in public health. And going through my third year rotations as a medical student, I found OBGYN to be a really great fit given my interest in public health and in women's health in particular.
Wow. Well, I think that that would be a remarkable legacy to your mother alone that you've become a caregiver and a researcher and combining those two elements of public health and clinical medicine. When you started in clinical medicine, what were some of the things that you began to see as it relates to women's health and your chosen specialty field that struck you as either bothersome or needing to investigate further?
Sure. So one thing that's been on my mind for a while, and I'm starting to pursue some research in this area, is the influence that health insurance has on patients' health and long-term outcomes. And in particular, what I mean by that is we have greater than 50% of patients who have Medicaid coverage for pregnancy in this country. And Medicaid coverage for pregnancy ends at about 6 weeks postpartum. And there's been a lot of talk about maternal mortality lately and how maternal mortality is increasing in the United States. But what we're starting to see is there's some emerging data showing that it's really maternal health and cases of maternal mortality in the postpartum period that are increasing. And thinking about that vulnerable time that really extends through the first year postpartum, and knowing that many women lose their insurance coverage at just 6 weeks postpartum is, I think, a really difficult problem that we're starting to recognize and grapple with. And I think that there's definitely some important work to be done there. And is one thing with my own patients that I see that can be really frustrating. We know in the U.S., for instance, that the leading cause of maternal mortality is complications associated with chronic conditions. And chronic conditions often need to be managed over the life course, not just during a pregnancy episode. And having patients who lose insurance coverage so quickly after delivery can be really kind of tricky. And I think thinking about ways in which we can connect women with the resources that they need to maintain their health, not just during pregnancy, but between pregnancies, is something that we really have to come together and figure out in order to really make a dent in maternal mortality in the U.S.
Well, I wonder if you could just briefly give us a example from your own experience. I mean, I know, and I was just shocked to see the data on really the failure to dramatically reduce maternal mortality, in addition to the disparities in care for African-American women, huge disparities. What do you see? Do you have a patient that stands out or something that you've seen that really helps us understand this?
Two things jump into mind. So the first is that we know that half of all pregnancies in the U.S. approximately are covered by Medicaid, meaning that many of those women will lose insurance coverage at just 6 weeks postpartum. And half seems like a staggering number, but when you look at those data by race and ethnicity, it's much higher proportions of African American, Hispanic, other racial and ethnic minority women who have gaps or transitions or loss of insurance coverage in the postpartum period compared to non-Hispanic white women. So for instance, while, you know, the number is 50% overall, for African American women, that number is closer to 70% of women maybe losing insurance so soon after pregnancy. I think we also see issues with what insurance is willing to cover during a pregnancy. For instance, recently the number of ultrasounds that we do in pregnancy or for certain insurance plans has been scrutinized a little bit more closely. And I had a pregnant patient who was worried about the out-of-pocket cost for an ultrasound. So early in pregnancy, we often do ultrasounds to date a pregnancy and to figure out what one's due date is, which is important for a lot of prenatal care. And this patient asked me to please not do an ultrasound because she didn't think that she could afford it.
Wow. You know, I am struck by the recent article that you did on looking at these adverse health outcomes associated with substance use in pregnancy. When's the first time that you can remember seeing an adverse health outcome relating to substance abuse? And how did that impact you to decide to do maybe research in this area?
Sure. So I do have to say that my residency training in obstetrics and gynecology was really in the midst of the opioid epidemic, where we were really just recognizing what was going on. And the beginning of my residency training, we really didn't see or recognize it as such. And towards the end of my pregnancy, it was a far more common occurrence that we were admitting women with substance use disorders, or maybe it was just that we were knowledgeable to screen and recognize it as such. But I think that one thing that was striking to me is that our patients are also becoming more medically complex, and we're seeing more and more patients with chronic conditions. And I think the opioid epidemic was kind of a lens through which we sort of recognized that at the same time. So a patient wasn't just coming in, for instance, with diabetic ketoacidosis, but in with an overdose complicated by diabetic ketoacidosis. And I think the confluence of the two really increased the acuity of our patients over a short period of time.
So it's interesting. I do most of my research in nicotine addiction, and we've made dramatic improvements in actually women not smoking during pregnancy. We still have a problem with postpartum going back to smoking, but during pregnancy, majority of women will quit. So I was really shocked to see that this was not the case. There had not been dramatic declines in opioid use and other substance abuse. In fact, there had been increases. Tell us briefly how you decided to do a study, and then we're going to take a short break and we'll pick up on the detailed study. How did you decide to do a national study?
So in some of our earlier work, we looked at rates of chronic conditions by different sociodemographic factors. So we looked at rates broadly of chronic hypertension, diabetes, asthma, substance use disorders, and a number of other conditions by insurance coverage, by income, by rural compared with urban residents. And one of the points and figures that came out of that study that was really striking to me was the rural compared with urban difference in rates of substance use disorder that we identified, with higher proportions of delivering women in rural areas having substance use disorder, and that rate was really increasing pretty dramatically over the last 10 years. And there had been some data published on rising rates or disproportionate increases in opioid use disorders in rural areas. But we knew that wasn't going to account for all of the disparity. So we took a closer look at the different ICD-9 codes that comprised this difference in substance use disorder across rural compared with urban women in pregnancy. And what surprised us was that actually amphetamine use disorder accounted for a significant portion of the disparity as well. So with this study that we're about to talk about, basically we decided to delve deeper into these data to ultimately examine trends and rates of both opioid and amphetamine-affected births by census region and by rural compared with urban residents.
Well, we're going to dive deeper after we take a short break, including understanding what are ICD-9 codes. but we're talking with Dr. Lindsay Adman, physician and assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan, about an important new study that she has in the American Journal of Public Health. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking about the recent rise in opioid and meth use in pregnancy. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Lindsay Adman, physician and assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Michigan, about the recent rise in opioid and meth use in pregnancy. And right before the break, Dr. Adman, you were talking about some of the work that you had done looking at rates of substance use in kind of the rural versus the urban areas and seeing some increased rates of substance use in the rural areas, but that didn't account for all of the discrepancy. And this began to lead to some additional research questions. What did you want to know, and how did you go about finding it?
Sure. So we identified higher rates of substance use disorder among rural women compared to urban women, specifically in looking at pregnant populations. And there had been some published literature saying, wow, we're really seeing increasing rates of opioid use disorder in pregnancy. But we didn't think that opioid use alone accounted for all of that disparity based on numbers that had been published in other studies. So we used a national data set that captures information from hospital discharges. And basically the information that this data set captures includes diagnoses and procedures that happen. And we specifically looked at hospitalizations for an obstetric delivery. What we did was look at charts that identified substance use disorder, specifically charts that identified opioid use disorder and amphetamine use disorder. And we examined rates of these conditions affecting birth by census region and in rural compared with urban counties.
And what did you find, and were you surprised?
Sure. So in total, between 2004 and 2015, we identified approximately 82,000 deliveries affected by amphetamine use and 180,000 deliveries complicated by opioid use. And for each substance, use increased disproportionately across rural compared with urban counties in 3 out of 4 census regions. In total, by 2014 to 2015, opioid use disorder was identified among about 6 in 1,000 deliveries, and amphetamine use disorder was identified among 2 in 1,000 deliveries in the United States. And in certain areas of the United States, these rates were much higher. Opioid use disorders were largely concentrated in the rural northeastern United States, and amphetamine use disorders were largely concentrated in the rural western United States. And I think the amphetamine use disorder findings were particularly surprising and striking. There's been a lot of attention in the media over the last 4 to 5 years about opioid use disorder, certainly about rising rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome, but there really hadn't been much on meth use. And there was sort of a peak in the early 2000s that, when this data was last looked at, was kind of dropping off. And no one had looked at these data in about 10 years. So it was very surprising to us that the rates of use and the number of women and neonates affected were so high.
I just want to repeat the numbers you said, because they're so striking. You said 82,000 amphetamine pregnancies affected and greater than 100,000 opioids. And this is over what period of time?
Between 2004 and 2015.
So a 10-year period of time. I think for most of the people who don't live in the statistical world, this would be a silent epidemic. Not silent from the standpoint of it's happening, but maybe silent because they don't see it.
Yep, and I think when you drill down to the areas in which use is really the highest, some of those numbers were really striking to me as well. So in 2014 to 2015, the last 2 years of available data, amphetamine use disorder was identified among approximately 1% of all births in the rural western United States, so 1 out of every 100. And that was actually higher than the incidence of opioid use in most regions. And then the highest incidence of opioid use was identified in rural counties in the Northeast, complicating approximately 3% of births. So when you think about 1% of births in the rural western United States being complicated by amphetamine use and 3% in the rural northeast being complicated by opioid use, I think you start to think about some other issues that are going on in those areas. We know that in rural areas over the last 10 years, access to obstetric services has declined. And we also know in rural areas, it's harder to connect with treatment for substance use disorders. So I think we really see these increases happening in places where we may be concerned about decreases in access to treatment and to care during pregnancy.
Yeah, you talked about that early on, about kind of the disparities that are even worse for those who may ordinarily be discriminated against and worse in access to care. And of course, the outcomes of care for those who are addicted to opioids and amphetamines and obstetrically in delivering babies are pretty draconian.
Yep.
Like heart attacks or heart failure or bad high blood pressure called eclampsia and things like that, things that you probably see not infrequently.
Sure. So there had been a good amount of literature before we published this study looking at neonatal abstinence syndrome. So looking at rates of NAS, as it's called, among neonates born to moms with opioid use disorder. And more limited data on the mother's health at the time of delivery. And I will say I think we need to recognize a major limitation of these data is that we're not able to look at treated versus untreated opioid use disorder. So we don't have different outcomes or outcomes separated out for moms who were able to obtain treatment compared to those who weren't. And that is definitely an interesting area for future work that nobody has really done yet. But I will say that our data showed higher rates of preeclampsia, preterm delivery, severe maternal morbidity and mortality across both groups. But actually, there's been a lot of attention paid to opioid use in pregnancy lately. But what was really striking is that for each of those, the rates of the adverse outcomes, so of preeclampsia, preterm delivery, and severe maternal morbidity and mortality, were actually higher among moms with amphetamine use compared to moms with opioid use.
The MET use, the amphetamine use.
Exactly.
So I'm going to give you a promotion. I'm taking you from assistant professor to making you the Surgeon General of the United States, and I'm giving you, let's just give you $1 billion to start with. What would you do with it to make a difference here? And maybe money isn't all that's needed, but what needs to be done?
So I think a couple things. I think when we think about prevention efforts, we really need to focus more broadly on reproductive age women, regardless of pregnancy status. And to date, that's really not been a major priority population for research or programmatic funding. I think, too, is that we need to be able to recognize women who are affected by these conditions and connect them with treatment. And there are laws across a number of states that actually punish women for disclosing substance use in pregnancy.
Hmm.
And these laws have been condemned by all major medical organizations, American College of OBGYN, American Academy of Pediatrics, American College of Family Medicine, because we know that these laws actually decrease the likelihood that a woman will disclose substance use to a physician and decrease the likelihood that she'll be connected with treatment resources. And actually, these laws disproportionately impact women in more rural states. And I think that we really need to advocate for changes in this legislation. And then as we talked about earlier, there's really emerging data showing that the postpartum period is a particularly high-risk time for overdose, particularly opioid overdose. And I think it's really important to consider pregnant and postpartum women as priority groups for treatment access and for treatment continuation. So I think part of the piece when we think about the increased risk for opioid overdose in the postpartum period is that we know many of these women are going to lose their insurance coverage at just 6 weeks postpartum. So thinking about ways that we can continue to connect women with treatment resources that they may have been first connected with in pregnancy, I think is really important in terms of her health, her family's health, and public health in general.
It's good public policy, and it's also common sense. As we finish up, is there a final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think really these data underscore the need for the maternal health community to direct attention not only towards opioids, but towards the use of other substances as well, certainly amphetamine use disorders, and recognizing that at times opioid disorder doesn't occur in isolation, that in a lot of cases there's comorbid use of other substances, and in addition to that, mental health conditions. And I think we need to take a holistic view of the patients that we're treating. And I guess one thing that I would add is that there's data on co-location of both addiction treatment resources and prenatal care or psychiatric care in the same clinic, and that's been associated with improved outcomes. So I think one thing that we really should be looking at is interventions that involve co-location of prenatal care and substance use services as a way to improve gestational outcomes and really trying to make that the standard of care.
Well, we believe that that's likely to happen with your research, and I can see the next chapters evolving as we speak. We want to thank you. We've been talking with Dr. Lindsay Adman, physician assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, University of Michigan, about your research on opioid and meth use in pregnancy. Thank you for being our guest today on Your Health.
Thanks, Adam. It was great to talk with you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about Your Health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes responding to health questions and concerns. If any listener has a question they'd like us to address on any upcoming show, they can send a comment or question to yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I've heard of the move to do telephone medicine, and I'm wondering if that extends to things like urinary tract infections. I'm a male who recently had burning when I urinated, and I really thought I had an infection. My doctor, however, told me I needed to come in to be seen. The test confirmed the infection that I thought I had, but it cost $150 to go in and do so. This seems ridiculous, as couldn't my doctor have just called in a medication for me?
Well, we certainly understand the feeling here, and I will say that urinary tract infections in men are much less frequent than in women. And so when I first heard this question, I thought, oh, well, this is a woman. And if this woman had had multiple urinary tract infections and then had a good long-term relationship with a provider and called up and said, I've got another urinary tract infection, it might recommend just to go on and treat it. On the counter side, we do see resistance coming up. And so the bacteria in the urine could be resistant. And so you sometimes will do a culture at the same time you look at the urine to document it's an infection and then see what the bacteria is to make sure that the drug you're providing works and you don't have a resistant bug. Maybe many patients don't know that.
Right.
The other thing many patients may know is a lot of times it's not a urinary tract infection. It could be a prostate infection. It could be inflammation, but not infection. And so you can only do that with a test. Now, a real question is, in the kind of the practice of the future, will patients need to see the doctor to get the test, or can they just come to the laboratory and then talk to the doctor over the phone? Maybe we can save a visit, save some time. That, I think, is a realistic possibility.
That makes sense.
And I bet you would prefer, if you didn't necessarily actually have to see the doctor, you didn't have a fever, you weren't vomiting, you think you have urinary tract, come in, give a urine sample, and then get a phone call later that day.
Well, streamlining the process always helps.
Yeah, it seems reasonable. I think there is increasingly things that we will do that way, but it also really still helps to have a physician that you've talked with and that you trust.
Yeah.
And that the physician knows you too.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. What's our very next House Call, Laura?
I was once in treatment for alcohol abuse, but I overcame that and I haven't had a drink in 6 years. I do, however, smoke marijuana daily as it helps me deal with stress and keeps me from wanting to return to alcohol. My therapist says this actually raises my risk for a relapse, but it seems to me that increasingly smoking marijuana is more like smoking cigarettes. It may not be good for you, but it's better than some other drugs. What do you think?
Oh, I think this is a minefield.
Right? Yeah.
I think
there's
this is a
so
really difficult situation here. You know, well, first off, nicotine is addictive. Marijuana right. certainly can be addictive. And one addictive behavior certainly predisposes you to other addictions. And so we know that people who give up all addictive behaviors actually are less likely to relapse, just as this person relates from their therapist, right. than people who continue with more than one addiction, because it's very easy to relapse. I mean, you might, when you smoke marijuana, you might have a desire to use it. Now, if you're treating depression or if you're treating chronic pain, well, maybe there are ways to treat those conditions without the marijuana. But clearly, if you're using marijuana on a daily basis, you probably are addicted to marijuana.
Yeah, that's frequent use.
That's frequent use, yeah. and maybe even abuse. On the other hand, you're right. Increasingly, people look at marijuana like a drug, like cigarettes. But, you know, cigarettes are deadly.
Yeah.
We will find out more research on marijuana. It's not like it's a free element in terms of health consequences right. here. So I think that this is complex. Is it better that you're not doing alcohol every day compared to the marijuana every day? Well, probably. The consequences may be less dramatic on those around you,
mm-hmm.
but it may be that also the therapist is also correct here. So
right.
we try to find out ways that it's a win-win for you and the therapist. We really think this is a complex issue. And I would suggest really working with your therapist and seeing how others view this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for that question. What's our very last house call?
I was recently diagnosed with blood clots in my legs. This really surprised me since I hadn't had any surgery, I had done no extensive travel, and my family history doesn't include any of this. I'm 50 years old, and when my doctor asked if I smoked, I said yes. He said that's the cause, and it's a major risk factor for blood clots. I really had no idea. Why does this happen, and will I have more blood clots even if I do quit smoking?
Well, it's a great question, and the simple answer is yes, it is a risk factor.
Right.
And we know because smoking kind of stimulates clotting factors. It stimulates the stickiness of the blood vessels and the platelets and this abnormal cascade that easily leads to clots. It leads to increased risk of clots in the lungs and pulmonary emboli. It's particularly deadly smoking combined with birth control pills in women over the age of 35. Lots of things people may not be aware of, but once you know it, the answer is clear. You give up the
yeah.
smoking. You had about a million reasons. Now you have a million and one.
Yeah, cut that risk out.
Risk out. Get some help. You might need some help with a treatment provider, or call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. These phone lines that you can call in every single state in the United States and get free counseling, sometimes free medication. And then, you know, will you get a clot in the future? Well, it'd be certainly less likely, and you don't necessarily need to be on a blood thinner after a couple months of active treatment once you've removed the risk factor. If you were to get another clot, you should look to see if there's some other reason in addition to the smoking.
That's certainly not going to hurt to quit smoking in terms of your outcomes, I would imagine.
No, I think in light of our conversation today about substance use and pregnancy
yeah.
with Dr. Abman, we'd get wholehearted support for eliminating
right.
all substance use
right.
In all kinds of settings. Well, that'll conclude our house calls, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can share any questions you have by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Lindsay Adman. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.